down to business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
So, getting on with today's business. First up, we'll take a look at the business stories making this morning's papers. Joining me are journalist and author Valerie Cox and also Doug Keating, who's the head of communications at Avalon. Good morning to you both.
Morning, Bobby.
Morning, Bobby.
Doug, let's start with Cliff Taylor in the Irish Times, who tells us that Ireland is quickly becoming a better off society. And he has some stats to bear that out.
Yeah, so Cliff Taylor always has a thoughtful column on a Saturday. And in this one, he looks at some interesting statistics that emerge in kind of pre-budget data from the Department of Finance. And what it's looking at, and I just bore you with a couple of numbers, but I think it's important to make the point that in 2018, there were 177,000 what is called tax units. So that could be an individual or a couple earning over 100,000 euros. And he looks then, these statistics show that in 2025, the Department of Finance thinks that there will be almost 400,000 people earning at that level. So that's more than doubling in about 6 years. So a huge increase. Now, he makes the point, and I think it's important to make, that, you know, a two-person household earning 100,000 euros that, you know, aren't necessarily, you know, very well off or finding it easy to make ends meet. He goes on to explain that this is largely, he thinks, being driven by the huge levels of inward investment that we've seen from multinationals. And he cites a statistic from Davy Stockbrokers, which is that last year, 67 billion euros of tax income from either corporation tax or wages on those working for multinationals came from those firms. And that's up threefold on 2013. Yeah. So we are... I suppose, you know, the takeaway, a couple of things. You know, we are have hugely benefited from multinationals' investments. It is helping people take home more pay. We are hugely reliant on that for our tax base. That group earning over 100,000 euros pays 2/3 of all taxes on personal income in the state. And I guess the final thought is then throwing forward to the budget and, you know, what do we need to think about that? So, you know, he suggests we have to focus on that squeezed middle that aren't earning at that level and also the importance of investment in infrastructure because, you know, particularly on housing, it's been warned in other articles this week that we simply don't have the housing infrastructure in place to accommodate the growth.
It's a very telling article, Valerie. A stat that stood out for me was that of the 87,000 taxpayers reporting earnings of more than 200,000 euro a year. That was 35,000 in 2018. So that's in 2018, 35,000. In 2024, 87,000 people earning more than 200 grand. So, you know, we can't. It's like the stats are here.
Yeah.
The multinationals are paying a lot of people very well. Mm-hmm. And it is influencing society.
It is. I think it's very interesting the way Cliff makes that connection with the housing market. And he says, you know, you've these people on over 300,000. But he does make the point that the people who are just over 100,000 could be considered the squeezed middle.
Yeah,
you know, people who actually are having trouble making ends meet, even though it looks like they're on a load of money. And he said middle earners, he's calling these the squeezed middle. And he said there's enough people with a higher income to pay the prices for housing. But people in this category, i.e. the 110,000 group, that's the amount of money you need to be earning to buy a house. But that these people are finding themselves consistently outbid when it comes to getting that house. I thought that was very interesting. The fact that there are these people with over 300,000 is contributing enormously towards the price of houses just going up. And I mean, the number of cases I've heard of recently of, you know, I know the cases where people are, you know, putting a deposit on a house and then they're being gazumped because the buyer decides. I mean, I heard of another one just yesterday, a friend, where the buyer decides, oh, no, we'll go up a bit. And, you know, up huge amounts.
After accepting somebody's deposit.
Yeah, like I know two specific cases.
How scurrilous is that?
Yeah, and one of them took the house off the market to save paying the agent.
Yeah.
And then sold it quietly for more money. It's a bad situation. But these figures are very interesting.
Valerie, when I have you there, the Abbey you know, a noted cultural institution publishing a report around findings and recommendations of a long-delayed report on governance, which outlines a litany of unusual practices, unclear governance, a significant failure in record-keeping and poor handling of two issues related to National Theatre's former co-directors. Yeah. I knew something about this, having read about it in more detail this morning. Like, the governance issues here are quite shocking.
They are, actually. And even then, we don't have the specifics. I mean, a lot of it is quite vague, really. It's the events of 2019 to 2021. And there were all sorts of things. The handling of significant payments to ex-directors and related legal costs and so on. Now, the issues that are outlined by Crowe Ireland, they did this independent review, and they're talking about issues being handled by a former board member and a former senior executive after their departure. The involvement of the chair, which meant that the involvement of the chair in a couple of investigations, which meant that there wasn't an impartial voice there, which they needed. And there seems to be this big question about liability insurance. And at one stage, they say the payments to the former directors totaled 236,000. But the cost of the investigation and the HR process cost more than 1 million. Yeah. And that included a lot of legal fees. So they don't seem to have had insurance for their legal fees
and
included.
And just on that, like €1 million for an organisation, a cultural organisation, that I'm sure isn't awash with cash, €1 million on a HR process that includes legal fees is a staggering amount of money.
It is a staggering amount of money. And if you think about it, I mean, the Abbey has always had a little subsidy since it was opened in, I think it was 1904. And I think, you know, we can use Yeats' quote, which he stood up in the theatre in 1926 and gave on O'Casey's Ploughing the Stars. He said, "You have disgraced yourselves again."
Staying with matters theatrical. Indeed. Doug, we'll move on to Intel. Some pieces update in today's Irish Examiner, and also indeed Adrian Weckler has a piece in today's Irish Independent about the where next for Intel. And it is quite worrying at one level for the numbers of jobs that are employed out in Leixlip. But I think Weckler paints a more positive summary that jobs in Leixlip are unlikely to be affected in the short term, but the long-term prognosis for this business looks perilous.
Yeah, I mean, Intel is in a tricky position, and of course we take a big interest in it in Ireland because there are, you know, around 5,000 people employed in their huge facility out in Leixlip. Both the Examiner and the Indo picking up on a Bloomberg story yesterday, which is around what steps Intel might take to address the tricky situation it's finding itself in. Worth bearing in mind, Intel shares are down 60% this year. It reported a $1.6 billion loss in the last quarter. And amazingly, in Adrian Weckler's piece, he explained how Intel is now not even in the list of the top 10 most valuable chip makers in the world. So Intel, that name we have that is totally synonymous with this technology, is actually, you know, going down into the mid-tier. And Nvidia, the stock that we hear about every day, you know, is now worth 30 times what Intel is worth.
It really is extraordinary.
So what is being looked at is the potential that Intel has, is investment bankers are looking at potentially splitting up the business between the manufacturing side of it and the design side. And this is being explored as potentially a way of getting it out of Dodge. It's early days, so it's not clear that's going to happen imminently. Remember that they announced that they were going to cut 15% of their headcount recently. There likely will be some impact on the team in Ireland, but we don't know exactly what that is yet. But as Adrian Weckler does argue, and I suppose this is the more positive note to end on, is that the level of investment, the scale of their operation in Ireland is simply so significant for Intel that it's unlikely, you know, it's unlikely to disappear anytime soon, that they are very committed here. So look, whatever happens to Intel, and it's unclear, let's hope that for Leixlip and the many thousands employed there, that there is still a long and bright future.
Sure. One of the things that I noted was that this strategy of effectively manufacturing for others, i.e. sort of white labelling their product, that's another perilous place in terms of controlling the price of what it is you produce, that if you're producing effectively for competitors.
It doesn't feel like the strategy of the market leader, the American based.
No.
You know, that feels like the strategy of the kind of low cost competitor in some other country. And the fact that we're even hearing that kind of strategy discussed in the context of Intel perhaps shows how the playing field for the chip market has just changed dramatically in the last five to 10 years.
Well worth a read, both those articles in today's Examiner and indeed Adrian Weckler's piece in today's Irish Independent. Valerie, there's a company operating for, I think, a number of years, 40-odd years, down in Tullamore, an American multinational called Cardinal Health, sadly announcing 300 people to be laid off at the US firm's Irish operation. A total, the Irish manufacturing operation, we're told by John Mulligan in today's Independent, the annual wage bill there topping 13 million, a huge loss to the community of Tullamore.
It is. And in fact, it's also got, you know, quite a lot of money from the state because they've had grants of more than 6 million over those years. But I mean, this is obviously what we have to do to entice these companies in. But I thought what was quite concerning was the workers, I mean, it's not going to close for 2 years and they're going to be given a total of 8 weeks' pay per year of service. Now, that's actually going to be quite a lot of money.
Absolutely.
And organised property is going to be tax-free and there's 315 people being made redundant. And the chances are that many of those will find alternative employment in 2 years. But what I thought was interesting was that, this was from a report in the Irish Times, that Cardinal Health took a 90.2 million euro dividend from the Irish unit this year. Now, they say that news of that payout may sharpen the workers' demands for a bigger redundancy package. But it's an awful lot of money to be taking out of a company that you're then planning to close when it is obviously very successful.
And the point you made earlier about the 6 million support from the Irish government agencies, you know, where does that go when a company moves 90 million over to the US?
Depends on when they got it, I mean, some of these grants are repayable, others aren't.
I'd say that one possibly isn't, would be my sense, but I don't know. But we'll see. Time alone will tell. Doug, I don't know about your views on remote working. I have some thoughts on it, but there's a very interesting opinion piece in today's Irish Times about remote working still dividing employers and workers. My own thoughts on this are that in a buoyant employee market where employees are basically in the driving seat, the work from home will continue to be an issue. I think if we get a tightening of the employment market, it will be one of the things that will change. And I also note some companies now saying that if you want to be promoted or considered for promotion, you'll be working in the office.
Yeah, so I think in a buoyant labour market, you know, I think it's hard for companies to make changes they may want to make in terms of getting people back in the office more. The piece starts with an interesting quote, which says, CEOs are like orchestra conductors. They need all their people in front of them. It's in their DNA. They can't cope with anything else. So I guess I think it's true to say that I think people running businesses would much rather have their people in the office, and then the foot soldiers quite like, you know, being at home and having that flexibility. And my own perspective, you know, I think if I was running a company or owned a business, I probably would be that, like that CEO, like the conductor, wanting to have everyone in front of me. But as an employee, yes, you know, I have flexibility. I work 2 days from home and I do enjoy that. But I think the trend is, as you say, I think there is more expectation of people coming back. I think that FaceTime and being in the office and being present probably is helpful in terms of people progressing and getting promoted. And that probably is a lever that will be used to encourage people back in. But, you know, at the moment, the employee probably holds more cards. And so I don't see it changing.
I think the reality is, Valerie, I don't know if you agree with me, but once you get the taste from working from home,
Absolutely.
You're never going back there, are you?
You're so right. And, you know, if you read the things they're talking about here, I mean, suddenly all of these people have become family oriented and they have family responsibilities. And, you know, when they took the good 9-to-5 job, they weren't bothered about getting the kids to the dentist, feeding the dog, whatever. And you know what really puts me off? If you ring somebody and you don't know they're working remotely, you think they're in their nice little office at their desk, and the next thing the dog starts barking and they say, excuse me, have to put the dog out. And the next thing the kid starts whinging and they go, oh no, I'm just minding the child, whatever, because, you know, the husband or wife, whichever it is out of the office and I'm working from home. I think it's very disconcerting. I think we are not handling remote working very well.
Yeah.
There's a quote there, which I thought was very good, from Mary Connaughton, director of the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development in CIPD. And she said, because of remote working, there's been a shift towards people being responsible for their output rather than being at their desk at certain hours. And that's so relevant because, you know, if you're remote working, what are the benefits here? They're talking about going for swims, being able to go for walks while on a team call or something.
Yeah.
That's not what remote working is all about. It's about organising yourself so that your time at home is premium time.
Yeah, I also thought it was interesting that there's discussion in this piece about the sort of blurred lines around this issue where I'm feeling too unwell to go to the office. It is one thing, but are you too sick to join an online meeting?
So I thought that was very funny.
Where do you legislate for that?
Yeah, no, I mean, there are benefits, of course, mostly being with your family and the commute. I mean, the commute is awful for people. And I think they're enjoying a lot better health if they're not doing it every day of the week. But I also feel very sorry for people in small businesses, bosses, managers, people like that, where, you know, it's essential almost to have people around you to say, what do you think, Doug? Is that right, Bobby? Come up with ideas.
Particularly for younger people, Valerie.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was talking to a fellow last week who was telling me that he was at an online meeting and this girl who was a participant of the meeting was there. Our next thing was bing, bing, she was at the checkout in a supermarket and the person could be heard saying, are you paying with that by credit card or cash?
Yeah.
And then the whole meeting were there.
The boundaries around what is acceptable are being pushed way too far, I think, in some cases.
All right. Well, you heard it here, folks, working from home. Interesting piece today, Doug Cantillon always gives a kind of a nice, succinct analysis of a bigger story. They ask in today's Irish Time, what next for Aer Lingus services for London? Interesting because it appears that this service, which once would have been probably the most, I think it was at one time, the most valuable transport link in the world, the flights between Dublin and London.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at some stats. I think it was certainly back in 2015, it was the busiest city pair, at least in Europe, possibly globally, 4.5 million passengers per year. And it accounted for 18% of all the traffic going through Dublin Airport. So this article is basically off the back of news last week that Aer Lingus is cutting two of its flights to London Heathrow each day. That's taking it down to 10 a day for Aer Lingus. We've BA on four. Let's not forget that they're both owned by IAG Group. And I suppose it's always been the worry of how that would pan out, you know, whether they would maintain the services. We obviously have lots of lift into London from Ryanair to Luton and Stansted. One of the things this piece considers is maybe one of the reasons for the reduction in traffic is actually that because there are more direct routes from Dublin into the US to other parts of the world, that there's less need for that hubbing through London, that some of that traffic into London Heathrow
it goes
would
direct to the US or wherever.
Yeah, and then there is also this issue around the cap at Dublin Airport and capacity, which may force airlines to think about, you know, if I can only have so many passengers, you know, where do I direct them? But certainly, you know, it looks like the Dublin London route isn't quite the blockbuster it used to be.
Sure, yeah, and Valerie, one of the quotes in the article is, could there be more cuts to this service in the future? There's no indication of that happening. And as a commercial enterprise, Aer Lingus is absolutely entitled to do So if it feels what is warranted.
Yeah, I mean, they can do what they want and they will do what they want. But I mean, they're going to have their commercial hat on and probably realistically, they can't reduce the flights any further than that because the business is there.
Mm. Well, I have you there, Valerie. Don't look back in anger is a nice editorial in today's Irish Times. It gives us kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling about the old Oasis concerts of the 90s and Jack Charlton and Riverdance and all the stuff that was going on. And it kind of conjures up images of happier times.
It does. He says nostalgia comes for everyone in the end. And I thought I loved this quote. But as Marcel Proust knew, the true bittersweet pleasure of nostalgia derives from contemplation of one's own vanished youth and, by implication, one's mortality. And that's what all the papers are about this morning, talking about the 1990s and even Oasis, their memories of being dragged across the Irish Sea by their mother. Back to the farms and the summers they had and the wonderful simplicity. And they've gone out interviewing a pub owner who remembers, you know, having a Guinness with Noel and all that. Look, the whole thing is, and I know this is daytime radio, so we can't use certain words, but the whole thing is a mess, a great big mess. I know people who are queuing for tickets this morning and one of them was a quarter of a million buyers down the line and texted me just before I came in to say he'd given up. But I mean, how we can generate this nonsense and the pre-queues and the money. I mean, at this stage, Oasis tickets, if you get lucky enough to get them, you're being offered. Now, they're not premium tickets, as in you're not getting a free lanyard, right? And you're not getting a free drink and you're not getting anything. You're just literally getting in €480.
Stop.
Which is crazy money. I mean, two tickets at that price, that's paying a feckin' mortgage, you know? I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's very clear coming through this morning, there's huge dissatisfaction. I tried briefly and gave up because I was just getting an error page. You know, one would have to think there's got to be a better way. But I think the biggest thing that annoys me, and it's the point Valerie picked up on, that instead of tickets being, you know, they're €100 or they're €80 or they're €150 plus whatever mad fees they add, but they've started introducing dynamic pricing. So suddenly what is this, you know, a standing ticket, fairly bog standard ticket being offered for, you know, €400, which is crazy. So, you know, I would love to go. I didn't get a ticket, but, you know, Noel and Liam, you're leaving a bad taste in the mouth of your many fans in Ireland at the moment, I'm afraid.
And the only option now is through Ticketmaster. You know, that you don't have any
Bobby,
other
you'll hook us up. Valerie and I have great faith. You'll hook us up.
We're all off to Oasis.
Bobby, I want two, okay?
And very finally then, we're told about how to jog a memory that's on the tip of your tongue, Valerie. Really, you got to think about something else. So,
Bobby,
walk us through this.
I think this article is a load of rubbish, actually.
Good.
It's coming from a scientist.
You don't know to speak your mind, Valerie.
Well, I mean, read it, you know.
That's why we have you here, Valerie.
This is a Cambridge neurosurgeon, University of Cambridge neurosurgeon.
I know, and this is all he could come up with. Just calm down and relax. Hello. I mean, if you can't think of something, of course you're going to go off and do something else. And then miraculously, it might pop into your head. And that is the way the human brain works. I mean, during the day, I'm sure it's often happened to you that you've read somebody's name or you've seen something and a little memory pops into your head. So what he's actually saying is don't concentrate on, you know, squeezing your brain and trying to figure out
just
what it
relax
was.
Relax and it'll come.
Yeah. I mean, I met a man the other day. I hadn't a clue who he was, but I knew him from somewhere and he knew me. And I was just being polite, thinking, I don't know this man's name, you know. And afterwards, it did just pop into my head. But it doesn't take a neuroscientist
to
tell you that.
He's stating the blindingly obvious, we think, Bobby.
Absolutely.
All right, that's why we have you here, Valerie Cox. We love you. And Doug Keating, thank you for a great review of the business stories and indeed a few others this morning.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.